The following recording by the LA Sound Posse is a talk given by Dr. Barry Hewlett, who is professor of anthropology at Washington State University. Titled Ebola, Culture and Politics, it is a preview of his forthcoming book, Ebola, Culture and Politics, The Anthropology of Emerging Disease. The talk was given on October 27th of 2005 at the Barrick Museum Auditorium in Las Vegas, Nevada.
I am very pleased with the turnout. At the end, for those people who are interested, there will be samples of the virus being given as you leave. Let me tell you a little bit about Dr. Barry Hewlett and his wife, Bonnie Hewlett. We went to graduate school at University of California at Santa Barbara, and he went off and did work with the Akka Pygmies in Central Africa, and I went off to Northern China and worked with Mongolian and Han Chinese. And we've stayed in contact through the years, obviously. Barry is a relentless field researcher. He's been doing field work for more than 30 years. And that's really impressive. And let me explain just a little bit, especially people who don't know anything about anthropology. In cultural anthropology, you're only as good as the data that you're collecting and the questions you bring to the field. And you're only as good as the imagination that you have. When you stop being curious about something, you no longer ask the people you're living with what they're thinking. So it's a constant dialogue of translation. What are you thinking? What does it mean in terms of my categories? What does it mean in terms of your categories? And it's a lot of tension. And no offense to my cultural anthropologists, but most cultural anthropologists only have one or two field seasons in them, and after that they're absolutely burnt out because it takes such a psychic cost. Now think about it. You spend every year going off to the field, trying to live with another people, trying to understand them. You pay a price for that. Barry has been back to Central Africa over the last 30 years, maybe 16 to 20 times. That's extraordinary. As I said before, most people go back once, two, three times. And every time he's asked a different question, from dentition of cavities comparing pygmy women and men, to health concerns, to adolescence. And now he's coming back with his work that's co-authored with his wife, Bonnie Hewlett, who teaches at Oregon State University now, and they're going to be looking at the Ebola virus, and they have a book that is in manuscript form. It's already been submitted. It's under review, and it'll be coming out next year, and they're going to give us a preview of that book, and the title is up there, The Ebola Culture and Politics, The Anthropology of Emerging Disease. Dr. Hewlett has published over 40 articles in major presses that are really hard to get into in places, and has over five books. His book, Intimate Fathers, which is now in the second printing, I still use in my course in psychological anthropology. It was the pathbreaker in the sense that no one had ever looked at father-child care, no one had ever looked at intimacy. And in many ways, Ebola and people's reaction, and in some senses, that emotionality that really defines us and makes us most human. After the presentation, of course, Dr. Hewlett will take questions. And so without further ado, I'd like you to welcome Dr. Barry Hewlett.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you very much for the very nice introduction. As mentioned by Professor Jankowiak, that what I'm to present here is really sort of a preliminary form. And we have rather a mixed group of people, and I don't know really who knows anything about Ebola hemorrhagic fever. And I encourage you to ask your questions in the middle of the talk. I don't mind that whatsoever, because everybody's sort of at a different place, and it may help to clarify for others. As Bill pointed out there, that I've been working in Central Africa for over 30 years now. I mean, I always like to say this is me and my first field trip, but actually, it's our son, who's now 24, expecting his own son. What I want to emphasize here is that the work that I'm going to describe here with Ebola is applied work in areas that I don't usually work. But in order to do this work, it's based upon that long experience. Somebody couldn't just sort of go in and do the kinds of things we did. A lot of these trips, we go there for 2-3 weeks, that's it, during these outbreaks and that. But in order to do this kind of work, you need that long-term kind of field experience and background. And the other thing here, previous to Ebola, for many years, I worked in other infectious and parasitic diseases. For many years, I worked with schistosomiasis control in northern Cameroon. And in my experience in working with schistosomiasis, which causes you to urinate blood, that's a characteristic feature of schistosomiasis. It's very common. It's number two to malaria in terms of the number of people infected. But the thing is that in my experience with schistosomiasis, it was quite clear local people had an understanding of the disease. They identified it as a pathology. They treated it as a pathology. It was something that needed to be treated. And there was a lot of indigenous knowledge about that. And so you need to understand that in terms of me going into an Ebola outbreak. You know, here I was in Cameroon and other parts of Central Africa, and then some books emerged, one book in particular called The Hot Zone by Richard Preston, that really brought Ebola to the forefront. It really talked about Ebola hemorrhagic fever, a variety of Ebola hemorrhagic fever called Reston, right here in the United States in Washington, D.C. And this got a lot of people's attention. And then a movie came out called Outbreak in 1995, which is essentially about Ebola. I was working with these other diseases, and all these stories about Ebola, a particular disease that kills people within a very short period of time and has a high 80-90% mortality, is that everything that I read about it, any kind of book that I came across, even documentaries about Ebola, gave this picture of Africans as being rather, you know, they were contributing to the amplification of the outbreak. That's what you hear from CNN. Local people eating monkey meat, and the monkey meat is amplifying the outbreak. There was story after story, and you never had a sense whatsoever in terms of the local people, in terms of how they were perceiving and how they were responding to the disease. So I became interested in Ebola after my other experiences with other infectious and parasitic diseases. Ebola hemorrhagic fever is a severe, often fatal disease in humans and non-human primates. It's named after a river in the Democratic Republic of Congo. There are two particular genera. You know, there's Marburg, which is another type of filovirus, and then there's Ebola. I'm primarily going to be talking today about Ebola. There are four different species or subtypes. Ebola Zaire is the most virulent. That's the one that causes 80 to 90% mortality. There is Ebola Sudan. Ebola Sudan has 40 to 50% mortality. And then there's another one called Ivory Coast and Reston, which is the one we had in Washington, D.C. Right now, my wife and I have worked with Ebola Zaire and Ebola Sudan. The thing here about Ebola is that we don't know hardly anything about it. It's been out there. It was first identified and described in 1976. We still do not know. There have been hundreds of researchers out there in Central Africa trying to find the reservoir. We don't know. We think it's maybe bats, fruit bats, because the virus lives and does not cause pathology in the fruit bats. We don't know the treatment when somebody gets it, and we do not have a vaccine yet. They're still working on a vaccine. So it's a particular virus that we know very little about. In terms of the mortality rates, just to give you some idea, the mortality rate for anthrax is 20%. With SARS, the mortality rate was 15 to 20%. And so that with Ebola here, we're talking particularly high mortality rates of either one, the Sudanese variety or the Zaire variety. Symptoms, the early symptoms are essentially like having the flu. Okay, you get a fever, you have body ache, weakness, muscle. And in terms of those of us who worked in Africa for a long time, it's just like, you know, you get malaria on a regular basis, and the symptoms when it first starts are just like many other things. It's very, very difficult to diagnose. Obviously, internal bleeding, in terms of what you hear about, you know, hemorrhagic fever is the bleeding out of all orifices. That happens, I believe, I forget, around 20, 30% of the time. It's not every case, but in terms of bleeding from the ears, bleeding from the skin, certainly bleeding in terms of diarrhea with blood, and so forth. Anybody who saw the film Outbreak has some sense of what Ebola is like. Diagnosis, very difficult. They're still working on simple tests, but it's very difficult to test. They essentially have to send the Ebola, if they think somebody has Ebola, they now have to send it to specific labs. Transmission of Ebola, direct contact with blood secretions, organs, or semen of infected people. It's very similar to HIV/AIDS in that way. Chimps and gorillas also die from it in the forest, and so that if you touch a dead gorilla, a dead chimpanzee, which many of the forest peoples do, you can get it this way. Or nosocomial transmission, that means transmission within the hospital. When you have unsanitary conditions, The needles are not clean, the beds are not clean. This contributes to transmission. The incubation period is 2 to 21 days, so when Bonnie and I leave the field, we always are very concerned for 21 days. And then once you do start with symptoms, if you do die, you die within 7 to 9 days. This is a map that sort of gives you the areas of the different outbreaks in Africa. The Sudanese variety tends to be more in a mixed savanna forest environment, whereas the Zaire variety is much more in the tropical forest. These are ones in terms of the Ebola Zaire, and this is obviously the country of Sudan, and this is where you find Ebola Sudan, but this is Uganda here, and you also have Ebola Sudan there. This is simply a little calculation that I did. The number of outbreaks is increasing. It was first identified in mid-1970s. There was this period or lull, but the number of outbreaks is increasing, and the number of cases is also increasing. When I was initially interested here, that I took a trip to Gabon, which had an outbreak in 1976, and the very first time I just wanted to go see what was happening. I was not invited by anybody. I just sort of went on my own because of my interest. Not many people were going to give you money to do the kind of things I was interested in. And in that early experience, I went up this Ivindo River here and went to the place of an outbreak in 1976. And during this outbreak, this first time taught me many things. I took a graduate student with me. We went up the river. We walked into Minkoka. Right here, this is where the outbreak took place. And my graduate student totally panicked. You know, I was going to take a GPS reading of the place, and he said, get me out of here. Just totally, totally freaked. And I realized, really, in terms of the fear with Ebola, I had lived in Africa for a long time, and I've been around death for a long time, I've been around rapid death for a long time. But with his experience and seeing his face going to this village really introduced me in terms of the fear, in terms of how easy psychologically getting the fear. The other thing here is that as we are going up the river, people explain that the disease, from their perspective, was caused by Izanga. Izanga were particular spirits, and particular spirits associated with sorcery. The outbreaks were taking in here, Minkoka, that was a gold mining area. And people would go into the forest for short times to collect gold. And Izanga attacks people who accumulate. People who do not share get attacked by sorcery. And they were explaining this as we were going up the river. And they said it's not unusual for us to think that in here that they were having Ebola problems because this was an area of gold mine and these people weren't sharing. And so that after my graduate student had this sort of panic attack, we walked out. It took us like 12 hours to walk out. And I slept that night. The next morning, I woke up, and I had the chills and a high fever. And, you know, I've had malaria before. That's not a big deal. I mean, really. But it's a bad case of the flu. But then I thought, what happens if it was Ebola? Because I had just come out, even though it had been a little while. And I thought, well, what happens if this is Ebola? And that when you are sick, when I was sick, it was so easy for me. And right away, the first thing I sort of thought about was, had I been a generous person in my life? Because as we were going up the river, people were telling us, I don't mind going up here. I don't mind going to Minkoka because I'm a generous person. I'm a sharing person. And if a sharing person, they don't have problems. The people who have problems are the ones who don't share. And so I had these reflections on my life in terms of, you know, was I a giving person? And, you know, I lived in Africa for a long time, but it really brought home how easy it is to develop. That's what sorcery is about in Central Africa, is about sharing. It brought home right away how quick and easy it is to get into that particular belief system. The other thing that happened on this trip is that we identified a new Ebola outbreak, and that was problematic. Before going up the river, I talked to the physicians. They said, it's all gone. It's all, you know, no problem. You should have no problems going in there. I'm not a medical person. You know, I'm a medical anthropologist, but I have limited medical training. They said, just go on up there. But when we went up there, we were stopping in small places, and we identified what Well, obviously we weren't sure, but half the village had died in a very short period of time. And so I came back to the city, talked to this guy's from Yale here, this physician's from Yale, and I'm explaining this to him. And previous to this, they said, you saw early in terms of how it's transmitted, and just simply by touch is not enough. So here I am with the Yale physician explaining the situation I just gone through up that river. And as I'm talking to him, he gets up. He says, excuse me a minute, I'm going to go wash my hands because I shook your hand when you walked in the door. I thought, what's this all about? You know, because the thing here is that they don't tell you everything. The other thing that happened on this trip is that as I was going up and down this river here, the people explained to me there were two groups of researchers. There were the Americans and there were the French. The French would come up, take blood samples, and never report back to them. There would be the Americans. They would come up the river. They would take samples. They would leave. And I talked to the Americans, which is the Yale team, and the French team from Paris. They didn't like each other. They didn't share. And so another thing that I learned, is that you have these international teams that are going up there. They take blood from everybody in the village, kids included. And sometimes the people were associating the death with taking of the blood. So that what I learned here is that these international teams do not cooperate. So that was an early sort of very early experience, very short time. And sort of from there, we try to do something a little bit more systematic. And this is the classic picture in terms of anthropologists, in terms of outbreak ethnography. Here you have the far side, and it's not a very good picture here, but you can see the idea is the anthropologists are coming and the local people are putting away all their televisions and things like that. And the idea is that the anthropologists are only interested in the traditional way of life, which is absolutely false, but the far side had a good. And doing outbreak ethnography, this is in Sudan, it's not like other ethnographic work as an anthropologist. The first thing I did when I got to Uganda is I said, because of my other work of infectious and parasitic disease, I said, take me to a small village. I just want to hang out, you know, and talk to people where Ebola is happening. And they said, I'm sorry, you can't do that. And part of the reason, because there was a rebel movement in the area. And so anytime I went out into the villages, I had to have a military escort. You know, and it was, okay, anthropology, what we call participant observation, is out the window here. But it was a very different kind of, tensions are high. People are dying. 10, 12 people are dying every day. Tensions are high. And at first I thought that people would not want to talk to me because when these outbreaks take place, you have people from Paris, from London, from Japan, from all different parts of the world who respond. And I thought, here's another Munju, here's another white face asking me these stupid questions. And I thought, nobody's going to want to talk to me. But what I found out real quick, I was the only one who really talked to them. The other people wanted their blood and their skin and all kinds of other stuff. But everybody else was a medical person. The people who respond to these outbreaks are, I was the first medical anthropologist in this particular instance here to participate in an outbreak. This is in Congo, and I'm sorry about how graphic this is, but this is in Congo a few years ago where Bonnie and I, the first day that we arrived in the village after driving like for 2.5 days, and that on that day, 4 teachers were killed because they were thought to be involved with the outbreak. And I'll explain a little bit more about that in a minute. But essentially, when we arrived in the village, people were very angry, and you can imagine tense. That, you know, Bonnie and I are professors, and it was teachers that were killed. We stopped handing out cards, you know. So, I mean, the thing is that the field situation, ethnographic work during outbreaks is different. Obviously, as an anthropologist, we focus on culture, and culture has dramatically impacts how we feel about the world. And obviously how we feel about treatment. This is a healer, a traditional healer, indigenous healer, a woman. And obviously we have the Western settings. And all I want to point out here is that our particular cultural background dramatically impacts how we feel about these different treatments and what we feel is appropriate. When we go into the field as medical anthropologists, this is the kind of framework that we're kind of dealing with. We want to know what are the local cultural models for Ebola. How are people thinking about what's going on in their community? How do they refer to it? How do they explain it? What are the symptoms? So forth and so on. Just to give you an example, this is the biomedical cultural model for Ebola, the one that most of you in this room would have, in terms of what is a cultural model, a biomedical cultural model that has a particular pathophysiology, transmission, causes, and so forth. But what I want to do is the very same thing in terms of how local people have these particular cultural models. There's also something called clinical medical anthropology, and which is somewhat different here, is that we want to try to provide culturally sensitive and appropriate care in a hospital or in clinic setting. This implies changing the way that clinics and hospitals are set up to respond to local populations. And I'll explain that more later on. In doing anthropology work, we talk to everybody who is what's called, we call like a stakeholder, anybody who like is impacted. So we talk to elders, elder men, elder women, we talk to kids. This was really fun. This part was really, really interesting, talking to kids about Ebola. We talked to the health professionals, the Red Cross, these are the folks, man. These are the frontline people. The Red Cross are the ones who follow the contact cases of people who have had contact with somebody who has Ebola. These people are the burial teams. They are the frontline. Incredible. We talked to indigenous healers, and we also talked to survivors. And here, this is in Sudan, 50% of the people survived. And so that we had, and there were 425 cases, so we had plenty of people to talk to. I'm just gonna go through two outbreaks. The Uganda outbreak in 2001, it actually happened in the northern part of the country. It was an urban outbreak, 50% about. But in an urban outbreak, that in the hospital transmission is very important. I mean, it was a major issue here. Many people got infected by sick people with Ebola who went to the hospital. But generally, the infrastructure is good, and in the northern part of Uganda, there was only one ethnic group, and that was the Acholi. This Imbarara here, this was essentially a military person who traveled to here, and that was a secondary. Most all the cases were up here in the north. Again, this is the Sudanese variety, drier area. You had electricity here, so they brought in a PCR machine so that they could do the actual test. This is a CDC, Center for Disease Control. They brought in a PCR to do the genetic work, to do the diagnosis in the field. And just to give you some ideas of what Gulu is like. This was the first time a medical anthropologist had ever been invited by the World Health Organization. And the reason they called me up is because the outbreak had been going on for a month and a half, and they were having problems. What was happening here is that people were running away from the ambulance. They actually have an ambulance in this part. It's an urban area. And when an ambulance was sent out to try to pick somebody up who potentially had Ebola, people ran away. What was happening is that the outbreak was amplifying again. They also wanted to know, were people afraid of being buried in the burial ground? Generally in Africa, people like to be buried right next to their home. But because of 10 people dying a day, the World Health Organization and the international teams decided to bury people next to the airfield. And they thought, well, maybe that's why they're running away. And they thought that traditional healers, because traditional healers in some parts of Africa cut skin, and they thought that the healers were amplifying the outbreak. These questions were answered quickly. You know, this is the ambulance. Here, you can see here, this is the isolation unit here at the hospital for Ebola. And it was rather simple. People were not afraid of the ambulance. What happens? The ambulance comes, picks you up, takes you to the hospital. You go into the isolation. You die in isolation. The family never gets to see you. They put you up in a body bag and take you to the airfield. That was it. And so, who wants to go into the ambulance? They thought that what was happening is they thought the international team, the Europeans, the Americans, the Japanese, they thought that they were taking bodies, taking them in on the inside, taking body parts out, and selling them. It was a body part business. So what we did is we recommended, they didn't do here in Uganda because it was towards the end, is that they tear these things down. And that we suggested in the future that they need a barrier, but that it can be transparent. What we really emphasized after this work, you have to make your activities transparent. This is the burial ground at the airfield. This was not an issue for people. They did not see this. Generally, you're buried next to your house because there's a belief in ancestral spirits that the relatives continue to hang out with you. But what they said is that in these unusual circumstances, it's fine to be buried out here. After the outbreak is over, we'll take a little dirt from the burial ground, transport it. We have flutes. They had these flutes that they make, and they call the spirit to come to the house. They weren't afraid of the burial ground. Healers. They stopped all traditional healing in northern Uganda because they thought healers were amplifying the outbreak. Because in other parts of Africa, they do cut. But in Uganda, Uganda has one of the highest HIV rates in the world. I mean, it's going down, way down. But what has happened, you know, these indigenous healers have changed their methods. We talk about it as traditional healers, but traditional healers change. They learn, okay? They modify all the time. And so they don't do that anymore. They suck. They do not cut. They use, as I'll show you in a minute here, but they pull things out. They no longer cut. The only reason that what was happening with healers, the reason they thought healers is that when some early healers died, they're mostly all women. When they died, they were powerful healers, powerful women, and they had lots of friends. And when lots of friends came to help care for the healer, they caught it that way. They caught it by caring for the traditional healer, not by the treatment of the traditional healer herself. The first thing I want to say is that in biomedical model is everywhere in Africa. I'm going to be talking about sorcery, some other things that are probably not very familiar to you, but I want to emphasize that they all know drug, they all know pharmaceuticals. This here is a treatment attempted by survivors in Uganda. When they were first sick, all of them took anti-malarials. All of them took aspirin. All of them took painkillers. So I want to emphasize that I'm going to move here to some other alternative kinds of explanations, but pharmaceuticals were very common. In Uganda, when people started to treat it as malaria or something, but after the malaria treatment didn't work, they turned to an explanation called YAT. You can see these are all the parts of the cultural model here. It's a substance, an object that enters the body. And so the idea was to try to extract it. And so in families where they had many deaths from Ebola, they brought in a healer to try to extract. You saw that object there. That was the stuff that healers extract. And what happened was the healers came in, they extracted stuff, but the deaths continued. What people said is, boy, that was a ripoff. And so then as deaths continued, they switched to another explanatory model. And this is called GEMO. This particular explanatory model, it's a bad spirit that comes with the wind. It's a spirit that comes from the wind. It's due from not respecting particular spirits in nature. But the big shift here is that somebody who has GEMO, you can get it from somebody who's just physically next to you. What I really want to emphasize is that in terms of preventing GEMO, they had a protocol. How to prevent it? You quarantine. You quarantine and isolate the patient in a house. You have a survival of GEMO, feed and care for the patient. You mark the villages. You mark the houses that have GEMO. You stop all dances. You stop all sexual activity. The idea here is that you're trying to respect the spirit. You're trying to respect the spirits here. The point here is that there's an indigenous protocol for epidemic control. Again, you had hundreds of researchers coming in here, and the outbreak had been happening for 2 months now. Nobody knew this. It's an easy thing to build upon. The other thing that we pointed out is the number of women. This is an anthropology kinship chart. The people in the red have died of Ebola, triangle male, circle female. But it is a gender-based. You have more females dying in Uganda than males. The other site here, I'll go through this kind of quickly, is in Congo a few years ago, in the northern part of Congo. This is a rural outbreak. The transmission in the hospital is very small because there's not much of a, nobody hardly goes to the clinic. Zoonotic transmission, which means from animals, was high because it's rural. In the rural areas, in this part, people eat monkeys, antelope, and the rest. infrastructure is poor, and you have many different ethnic groups. Just to give you an idea, when I worked in Uganda, you had paved roads. This is the type of road you have in northern Congo. This is a monkey here that's being sold by a particular group of people. But game meat is a regular part of the diet. This is the hospital. After Uganda, you know, I wrote this long report to the World Health Organization saying you need anthropologists, you need medical anthropologists at the start. They bought into it, and they actually invited three of us, my wife, myself, and a French anthropologist named Alain Epelbois. And so our situation in the second outbreak was much different. We were there before the international teams arrived. We were the initial team, so the situation was much different. What had happened in Uganda is there was a lot of resistance. There were particular things, and this is where you get the clinical medical anthropology, changing clinical care. We suggested that in terms of burial, that you bury the, you know, that people like to bury part of their belongings with them. Previously, they had been burning them all. We said, let's put them in the coffin. Previously, the international teams would just go in and burn all the mattresses and everything in a house, and sometimes they ended up burning the houses down of individuals. But here we suggested that you have to ask people where you want it to be burned, if you want it to be burned, because in fact you could disinfect things with bleach if they wanted. The other thing is that we allowed particular amulets, particular indigenous materials in the hospital for people if they wanted to have them. Another thing is that this is the barrier that I'm talking about. This is a film that was made by Alain Epelbois. This is a consultation with an ill person on the inside here, but just gives you an idea. Rather than having that big barrier, you have to make your work transparent. What happened in this area in previous outbreaks in 2000, 2001, 2002, before we went here, the local people literally got up their spears and chased World Health Organization out of there. They didn't trust them. They didn't trust them. And so we had to change. Okay? Things had to change. And the idea was to make everything transparent. This is where you have the clinical medical anthropology. Here we have a burial team coming out to wash and to cleanse their hands. And so the idea of introducing bleach to wash their hands in particular cases here, it was just a way to introduce the use of bleach and cleanliness. But the idea is to integrate and to change. In terms of cultural models here, in Congo, it started out as sorcery. People thought at first it was sorcery. And again, the cause of sorcery is generally lack of sharing. They thought that the people who were being attacked by Ebola and dying from Ebola were people who were not sharing. As we mentioned, sorcery is linked to accumulation. The thing is that when you have sorcery, it does not mean you stop taking malarial treatments or something. It's consistent with the biomedical model. Another explanation similar to this is what they call the Rosicrucians. Anybody know about the Rosicrucians? It's a group who studies mysticism, often Egyptian mysticism. But in Africa, you have these particular groups, but they tend to be intellectuals. But the way it sort of turned, it was explained to us, is that these Rosicrucians would meet secretly, and they would meet secretly and try to gain power and prestige. This is the teacher that I mentioned. It was thought that this teacher, the four teachers that were killed in Congo, were members of the Rosicrucians, the Rosicrois. And you can also imagine that the Red Cross also had problems in terms of the translation of the Rosicrois. But the thought is that the teachers were talking about Ebola before the outbreak started, so people were suspicious. Mamiwata is another form of this that is very common in many parts of Africa. There's a thought that there's a particular woman, a mermaid essentially, who lives in water, but very sexy, and tries to seduce men generally. And if men want power and prestige, this very attractive, sexy woman provides them power so that they can gain power and prestige. But in fact, she cannot have sex because she's a mermaid. But the idea here is that they offer the souls of their family members so that they can acquire this prestige and wealth. It's another form of this. This was the explanation in Sudan. And this is a very famous painting by a Congolese artist. People knew how to distinguish sorcery from indigenous disease here. What happened is, as the number of deaths continued, people shifted. from sorcery to natural illness, and from natural illness to epidemic. Like in Uganda, people made a shift. People made a shift in terms of cultural model for explaining it. I have to say here, before Congo, that Bonnie and I pretty much encouraged the sort of integration of traditional healers in Ebola control efforts. Because they're there, they're interested, they're healers, just like medical doctors, they're part of a healthcare delivery system. But I have to say that when we were in Congo, we had this one meeting with this one traditional healer, and he invited us, and there's a group of like 20 people there, and he said, we really want to help with Ebola control. But you know, there's really two sides to Ebola control. There's the dark side, and then there's the white side. Now, you guys take care of getting the gloves, getting the bleach, take care of all that side, but we take care of the dark side. And that, he said, we've already started to work on that. And with that, he brought out a list. He produced a list, a piece of paper, and we're sitting there, and he pulls out, and these are the people that they had identified through their activities to identify the cause of the Ebola outbreak. And the top four people were the teachers that were killed. At that point in time, my ideas about, I mean, many healers are great, but you know, what do you do, okay? I mean, that here you essentially have people who are identifying the murderers. I haven't talked much about the political economic part here, and that in every outbreak, I want to emphasize that there's always a political economic dimension. In Gabon in 1976, the thought was that the day or two before the outbreak started, that in Gabon you have French paratroopers. They were coming over the area. They were doing exercises in the area. And the very next day, they found a dead chimpanzee. Dead chimpanzee was infected with Ebola, and then everybody else in the village got Ebola. And everybody thought, the French paratroopers. And here, this one, I like this story here, and this other outbreak in Gabon, that at the time, you had a French president, Mitterrand. And Mitterrand, they have lots of nuclear plants in France, and Mitterrand didn't know what to do with the nuclear waste. So the story goes that Mitterrand talked to the president of Gabon, his name is Bongo, and they made a deal. That Bongo wanted all this money, he got all this money, but they had to bury the nuclear waste in Gabon. But where do they bury the waste? In this very, very remote part of Gabon where the outbreak took place. So the local people think that it's linked to nuclear waste. I'm going to skip the Uganda one. The Congo one is interesting. In 2003, this is the area where you have a national park. You have the people who run these parks in Africa are Euro-Americans, WWF, WCS, and that quite, I try to be nice here, but most of the people who run these parks, they're more interested in the animals than they are the local people. And so that the local people see the park officials as controllers. And what they thought, what the local people thought, was that the park director and some of the Euro-American researchers went into the park, poisoned some gorillas with Ebola. And what happens when an outbreak takes place is that all hunting is stopped, and people can no longer go in the forest and hunt for game meat. As I mentioned, game meat is part of everybody's diet on a daily basis in this area. And so it stops people from going into the forest. So what, from the local people's perspective, here we are again, Euro-American control of us. They're trying to keep us out of the parks. They don't want us to hunt those animals anymore. There is a pattern cross-culturally that they're trying to do a little bit of cross-cultural work. At first, people start with familiar cultural models. And then after a certain time, as deaths continue, you have extraordinary cultural models. You have scapegoating, stigmatization, conflicts. Fleeing is the most common. I haven't talked about fleeing, but that was common. I'm not going to talk about this theory stuff, but all I want to say is that we want to understand how human people respond to Ebola hemorrhagic fever. You have to understand psychology, evolutionary, this is part of biology here. When Bonnie and I go to Central Africa, we are afraid. Local people are afraid. That is human nature. We have an evolved psychology. There are particular ecologies that influence what you do in response to Ebola. And most of what I've talked about tonight are these models, these cultural models. The idea here is that you need a holistic perspective. You need a biocultural perspective to really understand the response to Ebola hemorrhagic fever. The medical one emphasizes one. Just a few other notes here, and that has to do with bioterrorism. That Ebola is on the A list of bioterrorist weapons. And they're hazardous. The agents are classified as the highest level of biosafety because of the high mortality. No vaccines, no treatment. It's in the highest category, primarily due to, like you saw in that tabloid, because of the fear, because of the psychological factor that can be amplified so quickly here. I mean, the former Soviet Union conducted experiments and produced filoviruses in the 1980s, 250 metric tons of Marburg, which is the other filovirus, were reportedly produced. And they were conducting experiments to try to make it in aerosol. And so, I mean, some of you may know about the Japanese cult here that used sarin gas in the Tokyo subway in 1995, also tried to obtain Ebola in the Democratic Republic of Congo. They went there, but they were able to identify him before they were able to get it. So Ebola is considered a high threat in terms of bioterrorism. In conclusion, culture matters in terms of the cultural models, the history, the politics. The major thing I wanted you to take away here is that people living with these killer epidemics have accumulated knowledge over time. Local peoples have indigenous knowledge and practices to help control epidemics. You know, this idea that you see on television, that you see on CNN, that local people, all they do is amplify outbreaks, is incorrect. Do they do things that do contribute to the amplification? Some of their burial practices, yes, contribute to the amplification. But they also have a long history of knowledge of responding to these. And I think that we have a lot to potentially learn. We here today no longer live with this. It's been a long time, but they're coming back. And I just think that we have enormous amounts to learn. I've talked about the distrust of the international teams, history and politics, obviously here impacting, like I said, early on, the World Health Organization was chased away because of an earlier colonial history, and not just colonial, but neo-colonial, if you will, in terms of what's happening today with the game parks. That's neo-colonial. Anyway, I've talked enough. Thank you. Yes.
What actually took place with Ebola? As you pointed out, Ebola has no treatment, no cure, and so forth, and is very high mortality. What physically took place to control and restrict this from keeping people from getting on planes and flying all over the world and spreading the disease?
That's a very good question. The question is what actually happened when these teams go in? What do they try to do to actually control the epidemic? The first thing they do is these areas are quarantined right away, that those particular states or provinces or whatever are shut off. People need actual written permission to move in and out of them. Schools are closed, churches are closed. Any kind of public gathering is closed, you know, stopped. They have a long list of things that they immediately sort of stop in terms of controlling people in and out. And there's a heightened awareness at the airport in terms of individuals. I don't know if that...
Well, they apparently then have the political support of local and country to do that then.
Yes, at the national level is not... They tend to support. They're the ones who invite the World Health Organization in. World Health Organization generally does not go in on its own. It has to go in and invited by the country. And so that the country is ready, but the local people are not always, because of all these previous things that are going on that at the local level, I mean, that there are lots of issues going on. Yes.
I had a question for you, Bob, that might be more anthropologically slanted. For example, like in the case of hantavirus, that they had an outbreak here in the United States and the West, and the modern medicine came in to try to find out what it was.
Yes.
The local healers, though, didn't know what it was because the medicine man, even though it hadn't been seen maybe in maybe 100 years.
100 years, right. It hasn't been
and seen. They, because of their tradition, their healing, natural medicine man healing, they had a history, a knowledge of it that was passed down. So in the case of like Ebola and AIDS that just appeared from out of nowhere, right. Have you found in your travels in Africa, is there like a medicine man healing pre-knowledge that they have some kind of inkling of traditional oral tradition that right. evolved this knowledge that it might have occurred?
Right, the question is what about the earlier prior sort of knowledge about some of these things like HIV, other kinds of, you know, like hantavirus or something. The thing here is that you may have noticed, like from that protocol, it was a general epidemic control protocol. I mean, in the sense that it's used when they first had measles outbreaks, when they had smallpox outbreaks. So the other question is, a lot of people ask me in terms of, well, they learned that particular protocol from the West. But quite clearly, by talking to the elders, they have these particular protocols long before the colonial folks arrived.
Is Marburg infected to people?
Yes.
What's happened to that 250? What happened to the?
We don't know. I mean, the reports that I've read, they don't know. We don't know what Russia and the independent states have actually done with these programs. It's very secret.
This hysteria that's going on right now with the avian flu.
With the avian flu, yes.
It hasn't really gone into the human chain yet.
Right.
Right. But it has not been transported human to human. Yet we have this incredible hysteria.
Right.
And it seems to me, why don't we have the same hysteria with Ebola? Or do we?
For a while there, I think we did. For a little while there, but now
it's... Is that telling us that maybe we're getting a little overblown as far as this avian business?
That's a very good question. I mean, that what that biocultural model shows is that, you know, why can Bonnie and I go work in an Ebola outbreak? We have particular knowledge, we have particular cultural models that interact and that alleviate that fear. And so obviously with the correct information and a clear understanding, that can alleviate that fear. It's biocultural. And another study, interestingly to me, there was a study where they simulated a deadly outbreak, and what they found was, and they did it with nurses, and they did it with TV people, and then a lay population, and they found that the people who were the most panicky were the news people. Surprise, surprise, but it just shows you have to be, I mean, it really was clear that you have to be careful. Yeah.
How long will that 250 metric tons of marburg stay viable? I mean, it's not going to last forever.
No, you keep it growing. If you keep it under the right conditions there. That was obviously one of the big things, is how easy, in terms of it being a bioterrorist weapon, how difficult is it to grow? And they find that they were able to find ways, obviously, to grow quite a bit fairly quickly. And so.
How reliable is that figure? It sounds like a Rush Limbaugh.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. It's unreliable, I would say, but it's in the handbook for Ebola. I mean, there is that now, actually, but it's not authenticated. It's reported in several places. It's reported in several scientific journals, American journals, but actually authenticating it is another issue. Yeah. Yeah.
Barry, I was kind of struck by the fact that the World Health Organization, who traditionally has always sort of upheld the notion that there are cultural models that bring in traditional healers and traditional models of health and healing. But having worked with a lot of their projects, the funding doesn't really support mechanisms for bringing anthropologists in, medical or otherwise. Do you see that the same?
No, the question is, I mean, the World Health Organization, they say on paper that they're interested in social science, they're interested in local people's perceptions. But in reality, that's how I ended up in Ebola, because that's what I thought. I thought, now the thing is, in the World Health Organization, you have multidisciplinary teams. I called up the World Health Organization. I said, well, can I talk to your anthropologist who's on this team? I really want to know what's happening in the field. We don't have any anthropologists. Then I called up Center for Disease Control in Atlanta, because I know those people there. I said, well, who's the social scientist or the anthropologist on your team? Oh, we don't. You know, they don't have them. It's lip service, you know. And that's the same thing with bioterrorism. The bioterrorism, you know, I don't know if you saw on that slide, billions of dollars go into bioterrorism, but it's all the medical side. In terms of the social science side, and so it's the same sort of, it's going to be the same situation.
We'll have one more question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. AIDS has significantly reduced the life expectancy of people in Central Africa. Has Ebola been sufficiently broad-based to do the same thing?
No. Has Ebola been enough to have a dramatic impact on demography or life expectancy? The thing about Ebola, as you saw from the numbers, we have like 2,000 people in 20 years who have died. It's an emerging disease. It's an important disease, but I would rather spend my time on malaria. I mean, I've gotten into Ebola in part because of the politics with World Health Organization, because I was interested in making policy changes. But really, many more people die every day of HIV or of malaria, that there's a lot more to be done with these other diseases than with Ebola. So, yeah, thank you. Yeah. Samples.
Catch it first.
You have been listening to Dr. Barry Hewlett introduce his forthcoming book, Ebola, Culture and Politics, The Anthropology of Emerging Disease. He is professor of anthropology at Washington State University. The talk was given on October 27th of 2005 at the Barrick Museum Auditorium in Las Vegas, Nevada. This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We anti-copyright these recordings and share them via the internet, via community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of the creation of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD. You can download it for free at radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. If you value what you heard on this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, and thus becoming yourself a part of a decentralized, democratic, civic media.